Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, the channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson, and I'm here today with Dr. Michael Brennus to discuss his new book, For Might and Right, Cold War Defense Spending and the Remaking of American Democracy. Dr. Brennus, thank you for coming to talk to us today at the New Books Network. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I am the Associate Director of the Brady Johnson Program in Grand Strategy at Yale University. I'm also a lecturer in history in the history department. I went to graduate school at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Got my PhD in 2014, specializing in American history in particular, and writing my dissertation on this book, The History of the Cold War and its relationship to domestic politics. And I mean, essentially, my prior coming to Yale, I was taught at various places in New York City, and I was also the senior archivist for American diplomacy at Yale too.
Now, you mentioned that this book, For Might and Right, it grew out of your dissertation. So, talk us through the intellectual foundations a little bit.
Sure. So the impetus for the book came from just entering graduate school during the early Obama years. So I went to graduate school. I entered graduate school in 2007, so late Bush years. But I didn't really start to think seriously about a dissertation and writing one, researching one, until 2010 or so. And by that point, of course, Obama was in office, and we saw with Obama, his first major domestic initiative at least, was healthcare and passing in some form a universal healthcare plan, a public option. And I saw that debate fight play out and saw it in ways that I thought were interesting, particularly because of the contradictions that people were spouting in terms of their belief in private market to deliver health insurance, and their lack of faith in government to do anything significant to help Americans in terms of their healthcare. But I also saw that people very much relied upon Medicare and government programs that delivered health insurance. And one of the early memes listeners recall was, get your government hands off my Medicare. And I thought that was really interesting. It was an interesting way for me to, or it's an interesting way to see the contradictions. I was very stark and it became very funny, right? But there was something to that, I thought, that people obviously recognize that government is important, but they don't know that government is funding the programs that they think are important, right? Something to that extent. And I thought this was interesting given my own growing interest in defense spending and defense industry. When I first semester in graduate school, I took this class by Josh Freeman. Josh Freeman was a labor historian, longtime professor, just retired at the CUNY Graduate Center, on essentially it was on just post 1945 history, American history. And we read Lisa McGurr's book, Suburban Warriors, which if you haven't read it, and if listeners haven't read it, it's essentially about the rise of conservatism in Southern California. And what she argues is that defense workers in Southern California embrace conservative politics. And I thought, you know, given what's happening with the Obama administration, you know, things I started to read besides McGurr's book around the defense industry and how it shapes domestic politics, that I would write a dissertation that examined this contradiction, how it played out in the rise of the right. And what I found in doing the initial research, which took me across the country eventually, but doing the initial research for the book, was that people who work in the defense industry are somewhat affected by the defense industry, affected by the political economy of defense spending, don't reflexively espouse conservative politics. They aren't conservatives ideologically necessarily, and they're much more flexible in their politics. They're much more amenable to Democrats and Republicans, and basically what they want is people to deliver jobs and the benefits that come with jobs to them, i.e. good healthcare, things like that. And so that to me was interesting, and that led to me really thinking about how conservatism isn't the story here, or the rise of conservatism isn't the story here necessarily. And it took me a while to kind of get there, because I was held steadfast to this idea that I was going to write about the rise of the right and, you know, defense spending, but the evidence was showing something else. And so that eventually led me to make the case for in the book that really the political economy of defense spending creates a coalition of actors who are both employed by the defense industry or benefiting by the defense and benefiting from the defense industry in some sense materially, but also those who are ideologically committed to anti-communism, who would much more so fall on the spectrum of the right. And it's really this marriage of convenience between ideological cold warriors and people on the ground, local actors who aren't necessarily ideological, even apolitical, who really come to shape how we think about the rise of the right as it relates to the political economy of Cold War defense spending, and what that means in regards to the endurance of a national security state, a massive military budget, and how we can think about perhaps, you know, creating a coalition that would stymie, defeat, overcome that the endurance, again, the persistence of the military-industrial complex in American life.
So let's jump right into your first chapter. You pick up in about 1945. It's right after World War II has basically come to a close. What's that first chapter about?
Sure. So that chapter was it was the hardest to write because I was trying to do several things. I was trying to I tried to set the stage for how massive defense spending, how large military budget is coming to be seen as the only means necessary for the United States to fight and win the Cold War. That you have a decision made by elites, and when I say elites, I mean Democrats and Republicans, particularly in Congress, but President, you know, the White House as well, those policymakers who are ensconced in national security bureaucracies, making a decision about what it's going to take to defeat communism. And that decision it's a bipartisan one. There's a Democratic-Republican fight over what a post-war foreign policy is going to be, but they essentially come to terms with now ultimately that the United States is going to be in a position where it's going to have to fight ideological war, but also economic and military war. And it's going to be a war, you know, long peace, as John Gaddis has said. I'm trying to tell that story in the book, in the first chapter. But again, I was more interested in what this means for the political economy, the material products of this ideological consensus. Because again, I think the entire story of the book I'm trying to tell is that there's a larger connection that needs to be made between the grassroots and local actors and police. And so this story I'm trying to tell in that chapter is how Americans in general came to view defense spending as permanent, and why the Cold War came to be seen as ideologically necessary, but also materially necessary. And so I start off with, actors. The chapter starts out with actors on both the left and the right, saying that we need to have, particularly during the Korean War, a effort by the government to employ Americans from in the defense industry or by the defense industry who are in need of assistance. They don't have jobs or their communities need an injection of capital for them to stay afloat. And this is an argument made but on the left and the right. And so I start with figures like Gerald Ford, who's a Republican in Michigan, also Walter Reuther, head of the UAW, been very much not a Republican, starts off in social circles, becomes more of a Cold War liberal, but those two figures kind of set the stage for this ideological consensus, that is the Ford in Congress, Reuther representing workers who need this ideological consensus on foreign policy to benefit his workers, his constituents materially. And then it goes into a discussion of how really the fight in Congress in particular plays out over how national security, or should say the military budget, is going to be funded. And that story, I think, is unique because you have Democrats, and who I largely blame for, blame is the word, but I find responsible for creating a massive military budget, because they believe, that is, Democrats believe that it's the best way to deliver social benefits, the elements of social democracy to Americans in ways that won't receive as much resistance from the GOP, from Republicans who believe, in a post-war period that any program that is designed towards universal health care or full employment is a socialist program, and therefore it's coming from Moscow. And it's a way for, that is, Democrats, creating jobs, creating full employment, or trying to create full employment in some ways through the military budget. It's a way for them to kind of funnel social democracy through military apparatus and avoid the critiques they might receive from the right, which I'm sure many of us are aware of, given what's going on today, of course, in politics. And then the Republicans, of course, are put in a position where they have to either say, no, we don't want a massive military budget because, it's going to be a problem for, this is an insidious way to deliver, jobs and growth to Americans, or they're going to have to say, we don't want this massive defense budget because it's going to be leading to a garrison state, which is what some Republicans like Robert Taft fear. And so the story in the chapter is really how Republicans come to terms and Democrats come to terms with large-scale defense spending. And that once that consensus is again forged, particularly in Congress, it leads many Americans to think that this is permanent, right? Or that the growth of the industry as it continues, the defense industry that is, as it continues, makes many Americans believe that this is permanent, and they look for the jobs that the defense industry created during World War II and even prior to that during the New Deal to continue in the post-war period. And the lessons from World War II, I think, are in terms of this are quite clear. That is, in the event of a depression, right, full employment through military spending is possible, and that's what happens during World War II. Is that unemployment is about 17% in the late 30s, or mid-30s. And then it goes down to some 5% after the war. And I think that's key to shaping how Americans think about what the defense industry can offer them just to improve their livelihoods. And that's how this evolves, or how the chapter evolves. And by the end of the chapter, I conclude that what happens is that many Americans are benefiting from the political economy of the Cold War, but they're not all benefiting on equal terms. And this is sets the stage for the story that comes, which is that the inequality in how defense spending is financed, how the defense funds or funds in the defense budget are distributed to Americans, inherently shapes winners and losers in the process. That some people benefit more than others, but still Americans by and large want the political economy of the Cold War to give them jobs, to give them growth. And that's going to be a problem, particularly as we get into the 1960s and 1970s, when the defense industry isn't doing what it has been doing in regards to creating jobs like it did in the 1940s and 50s.
So to rewind before we get to the 1960s and 1970s, in your second chapter, we see a lot how this, what you've termed the Cold War coalition, sort of comes together, but you also start to see how it operates, and you've touched on this, at a regional level. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. So what happens is, during World War II, let's start there. During World War II, much of the industrial base of war making during World War II takes place in the Northeast and the Midwest, right? In Ford, based in Detroit, of course, receives a large number of defense contracts to build planes. There's many books on this for the war. There is places in Connecticut and defense companies in Connecticut who are receiving defense contracts to build ships. There are other places as well throughout the country who are of course getting defense contracts, but the industrial base of the defense industry is really in the Midwest and in the Northeast, Michigan, New York, Connecticut, places like that. But that starts to change in the 1950s into the 1960s, where during the Cold War, of course, we don't need as much of an industrial base. We still need an industrial base, but now what's happening is we're investing in innovative technology, and we're not so much, that is, we in the United States, is not so much in need of the same types of manufacturing that you have during World War II. And we're relying more upon, PhDs and scientists and engineers to develop these new weapons. So that's one thing that happens, but also, two, it just becomes cheaper to for factories to relocate to the South. And also it's more, for the United States, a matter of national security, of creating industries, creating military bases outside of centers that might be targets for a Soviet attack. So in the South and in the Midwest, in the Plains, that's when you start to see these, new centers of activity for the Cold War, or political economy of the Cold War. States like South Carolina, for instance, Colorado, Florida, and then going west, eventually into California, which becomes a large recipient of defense contracts out to the 1950s. And what I argue is that regionally, what happens is that the industrial base of the Northeast and Midwest, they're still getting defense contracts, but they see that the numbers are not the same. But again, this is sort of a zero-sum game. So they see that they're not benefiting, so they look to the South and that it is benefiting, and say, why is the South getting, or why are these new states getting these monies and we're not? And they get angry and antagonistic and look to people to blame, of course, as you would do, and they increasingly start to blame Democrats throughout the 1950s and 60s, and are advocating for, to whoever will listen, more defense jobs, which they remember rightfully so, is creating prosperity for themselves and their communities. And as the South starts to benefit and the West starts to benefit more from the defense industry, you see a pre-existing conservative politics that's there. Of course, people like Mendel Rivers, who is a representative from South Carolina, is very much a supporter of Jim Crow, but also one of the largest proponents of defense spending in his state. At one point, I forget the line, I'm probably going to butcher it, but Mendel Rivers delivers. This was the headline of a New York Times article about Rivers at one point. And one of his colleagues said that if you put one more military base in your home state, South Carolina is going to sink. There's obviously a regional interest in benefiting from this shift in the political economy, and that creates a politics that is very interesting. That you have, of course, conservative area that's still dependent upon, going to be increasingly dependent upon the defense industry, but also antagonistic towards the federal government overall. And in the North, you have, situations where people are antagonistic towards the federal government for not delivering on what it's supposed to be doing, what it's promised, what's been promised to them in terms of growth and jobs. And so it creates this coalition, as I say, Cold War coalition, of actors who in some ways are upset at the federal government and want their representatives, politicians, to do something on their behalf to continue the growth, continue the jobs that they've experienced because of the Cold War. And this puts, again, the situation of American politics and how we think about the rise of conservatism or the decline of liberalism, outside of those terms. It's a bipartisan that is benefiting from the Cold War. It's a really a bipartisan issue and problem. And this is a reflection of how the regional makeup of political economy, the Cold War, evolves after the 1950s.
Now, going into the 1960s, we get into Vietnam. And because of that, we expect to see certain kind of challenges to that. But how does that actually play out? Because I think you complicate a narrative of straight anti-militarism coming out of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, so what I'm arguing in what I see in the 1960s is, first, prior to the Vietnam War, there was a period of relative international stability. This is in the second chapter of the book, where after the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, there's a decision made within the Kennedy administration, even to some extent prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis, that we don't need to be spending as much on military, traditional military ordnance. There's a number of superfluous military programs that don't serve the national interest of the United States, because in the end, we're fighting a Cold War that relies upon nuclear weapons and nuclear supremacy, and we don't need to have as many tanks made, ships made, things like that. And so what McNamara does, and McNamara's by no stretch of the imagination, an anti-militarist, but what McNamara does is he's very much a man of efficiency and says, let's start cutting defense spending. We don't need as much, we can rely upon ICBMs, we can rely upon American nuclear superiority, and starts to close military bases around parts of the country, starts to develop plans, I would say in some ways, for defense conversion or converting elements of the defense industry into civilian purposes. And this arouses, as you can imagine, a lot of ire amongst people who benefit from the programs that McNamara wants to eliminate. And you have this brief period in 1963, 1964, where because of the international situation being one where you think that the Cold War is waning, that there's a thaw in the Cold War, that creates opportunities for Democrats like George McGovern, who's a Democrat from South Dakota, newly elected to the Senate in 1962, to create opportunities to think broader, think bigger than McNamara in altogether reducing in large numbers the amount of the United States is spending on military, And so McGovern actually creates this, tries to create this organization called the National Economic Conversion Commission, which is a very interesting plan. It's 1964 that he develops through discussions with Columbia economist Seymour Melman, who is a long-time proponent of disarmament and conversion, which would be a way, the commission would be a way to find where, find areas where the defense industry is in need of elimination or aspects of military programs are no longer necessary, and go in and just essentially give through the federal government find ways to study the problems that unions are facing and give them opportunities to be employed in the civilian sector in jobs that we would consider now to be green jobs, environmental jobs. And that's a really interesting, it's an interesting story. And I did not know about McGovern. I knew a little about his opposition to the defense budget for this, but I didn't really know how much he had tried to do and the coalitions he assembled in 63 and 64 prior to this. But this gets this, McGovern's plan conversion overall gets stymied because of and mostly defeated because of the Vietnam War. And what Vietnam does is does two things. One, it proves to, or at least it signals to Congress that we can't be in the business of conversion anymore, that there's now a war in Southeast Asia we need to fight. We need to be ramping up our military capabilities to confront that threat or supposed threat in Vietnam from communism. And two, it puts essentially the political economy of the Cold War in a position where it's now making money again from war in ways that it hadn't really since the Korean War. And so Americans are starting to benefit again from an increase in the defense budget. They're starting to see defense communities are starting to see an uptick in jobs. And so that relatively placates the constituents who are dissatisfied by the way things were going, in 62, 63, 64, who even up to 65, who would be amenable to conversion prior to the Vietnam War. But when the Vietnam War goes horribly wrong, as I would argue it was going to be, going horribly wrong as soon as the United States committed troops and a presence there, even before 65. But once it's proven to be a quagmire in 1968, you start to see the anti-war movement taking on a greater hold over American politics, greater visibility. There's a larger conversation in the United States about the military-industrial complex, which hadn't taken place again since 1961, when Dwight Eisenhower made his famous farewell speech, where he referenced the military-industrial complex. There are a number of books that come out in the late 1960s, early 1970s, talking about the need to nationalize the military, nationalize the defense industry. This is what John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous economist, makes, the argument he makes. There's entire generals coming out and saying we don't need this military-industrial complex anymore. The anti-war movement is protesting in front of Dow Chemical, which is making napalm. There's a critique of the military-industrial labor congressional complex that you start to see as well. The problem of this, there's lots to be said about the capabilities or the opportunities that are presented to this coalition of anti-militarists who are activists also, but who are in Congress, who are also in academia. Lots to be said about the opportunities that they have presented to them in the late 1960s and 1970s, but they aren't able to make or have enough traction in American politics to altogether create defense conversion because in the ways they want to, because of economic situation, the economic situation that the United States is facing in the late 60s and early 1970s in regards to stagnation of wages, recession in the economy. And what happens by the early, at the same time, you start to have this growing anti-militarist sentiment in the United States. You have a growing recession that leads to Americans clinging to their jobs, believing that their jobs, rightfully so, are insecure, and they want to have sustainability in their livelihoods. And so you have a situation where they're lobbying for the defense jobs that they had throughout the 60s, now in the Vietnam War, to continue, keep going. And that leads to a very interesting set of again, coalitions, both on the left and the right, working together, labor unions and conservative activists working together to keep defense spending high in ways that they feel will benefit both themselves personally, certainly in the case of labor unions, but also nationally, internationally, the security of the United States.
Now, in your fourth chapter, we move a little bit beyond the Vietnam War, and a lot of that sort of anti-militarist, anti-spending coalition is still, if not strong, in the conversation, but they diminish through the 1970s. Talk us through what happens in that decade.
So what happens, first in the 1970s, again, there's the recession that I referenced. And there seems to be, again, an opportunity here for anti-militarists to make headway. In electoral terms, that is expressed in the candidacy of George McGovern, now a candidate for president in 1972, senator, opposed to a large military budget, makes the military budget one of his key issues in Congress. Now in 1972, he's running for office against Richard Nixon. He eventually gets the nomination, advocates for an immediate withdrawal from Vietnam, advocates for an expanded New Deal, expanded social welfare state, universal health care, other things that Democrats or left liberals and Democrats were fighting for since the New Deal in some ways. And McGovern says we're going to pay for this expanded social welfare state through cuts in defense spending. And what he starts to say is we're going to have a $30 billion cut to the defense budget. And that's how we're going to pay for social welfare, expanded social programs, universal health care things. And he says, it's a sad thing that we have to rely upon the military to for jobs, right? There's no reason why we should do that. And we have to figure out ways in which we can, we can reconsider how military spending through military Keynesianism has hurt Americans more than helped them, and the national security of the United States and overall. So McNamara makes this case in 1972, and it really doesn't go anywhere. One of the problems that McNamara has in 72 is that he doesn't have a very clear conversion plan like he had in 64, which baffles me to this day. He basically just says we need to eliminate the defense budget, which is fine suggestion, but he doesn't have something that can capture voters in practical terms. And of course, there's a very powerful growing right that Richard Nixon is... he's catering to in some capacity, Richard Nixon, who was president at the time, and who will, of course, be McGovern's challenger. And so when McGovern loses in 72, it it's a defeat for the left, of course, and what they've been fighting for much of the 60s. McGovern seeming to be the culmination of the left and new politics and a presidential candidate, but it's also an opportunity for the right to make inroads into defense spending, into American politics through issues of defense spending. And I think the most prominent conservative who takes advantage of this is Ronald Reagan, who, of course, we know was elected in 1980 as president. But what I find more interesting than, perhaps not more interesting, but just as interesting as his election in 1980 is his run for president in 1976. Because what happens in 76 is that Reagan, by this point, Richard Nixon gets reelected in 72, but Richard Nixon has proposed and implemented a policy of detente with the Soviet Union. He is so-called, quote-unquote, opened China through diplomacy. He's engaged in strategic arms limitations talks with the Soviet Union. And Richard Nixon believes, many people do because of Vietnam, that we can't be having a tough military posture that it can't be waging wars in far-flung parts of the world for time immemorial, that we need to be more limited and constrained in how we wage our foreign policy. And of course, Richard Nixon's very cynical about this, but ultimately, in terms of his motives, but ultimately what this means is that many on the right who believe that the United States shouldn't lessen its tough attitude towards Soviet communism or communism overall are upset about Nixon and his policy detente, which is embraced by many liberals too. And they advocate for, again, renewal to a Cold War, renewal to Cold War containment, more akin to what you saw during the Truman administration, where Truman was responsible for the Marshall Plan, Truman Doctrine, and eventually, again, this large military-industrial complex being formed in the 40s and 50s. And Ronald Reagan is the candidate in 76 who is the candidate of the Cold War. He's actually, what I argue in the book is that he runs as a Cold War liberal in many ways. And he starts out, what's interesting about Reagan in 76, he starts out not really advocating or making defense a key part of his run for president. He starts his run for president by saying we're going to, you know, our key issue is economic issues. And he says, well, we're going to cut social spending. And we're going to have this, you know, across the board, arbitrary cut in all social programs. And we're going to reduce the size of government. We're going to get Americans off of welfare, things like that. And it's wildly unpopular. You know, he has just, it seemed to be this number that he has advocated for, billions of dollars in cuts. You know, it's just nonsensical, callous, and contrary to the interests of many Americans. And Reagan starts to lose in key states in the primaries, early states in the primaries, New Hampshire, other states like that, in the early primaries. And by the time Reagan's about to lose his run, he's challenging Gerald Ford in 76, which was at the outset who was president, after Richard Nixon resigns in 74. By the time that Reagan looks like he's going to lose to Ford, Reagan in, this is the key state here is North Carolina, Reagan starts to shift to talking about detente and talking about national defense and talking about how Gerald Ford is weak on military spending. He's weak towards communism, and he's leaving the United States exposed to a communist takeover, which has resounding salience, I would say, in the state of North Carolina because of the ways that the military shapes the state of North Carolina. There's several military bases, Fort Bragg and other places in North Carolina. There's some defense industries as well. And it's just also an ideologically captivating issue for many North Carolinians. And Reagan wins that state in the 76 primary. And that makes national defense during the Republican primary, I argue in the book, the key issue for the remainder of the primary, where Reagan didn't really attack detente too much or in very conspicuous terms, but by at the end of the primary, it's really what has shaped him and made him who he was as a candidate, almost to the point that Reagan won the nomination in 76. Reagan doesn't get the required votes at the convention, the Republican convention in Kansas City that year, but he comes quite close within, 100 votes or so necessary receiving the nomination. And he influences Ford enough to say during the Republican the platform for Republicans to say that they actually don't use the word detente. They use the term peace through strength, which harkens back again to the Cold War of the 40s and 50s. And then what's happening throughout this run that Reagan has in 76 is that he's gathering elements of the Cold War coalition behind him who both ideologically and materially support the national or the military-industrial complex, national security state. And he's doing so in ways by pulling Democrats into the Republican fold and securing the support of conservative activists who had been working on, organizing around the basis of national defense issues for decades. And so this is, I think, a key, perhaps somewhat overlooked story in the rise of Reagan, but also the making of not just, again, the right, but a coalition of actors who are drawn to right-leaning politics, even though they might not necessarily identify as conservative. And this is going to eventually influence Jimmy Carter, this coalition after Reagan loses in 76, is going to eventually influence Jimmy Carter, who is going to deal the after effects of the coalition that Reagan has assembled in 76, who continually push Carter to do more on defense spending, and Reagan doesn't do more really until 79 after the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviet Union. And then Carter initially embraces detente, tries to work towards a second arms limitation treaty with the Soviet Union after Nixon secured it, the first one in 72, and abandons that by 79, advocates for and pushes for financing the MX missile, Trident submarine, a number of programs that he thought were no longer necessary. But this then makes Jimmy Carter responsible for reviving Cold War liberalism just as much as Ronald Reagan, I would say, to a certain extent, maybe not just as much, but to a certain extent as Ronald Reagan did, and making Cold War liberalism again prominent in American politics in ways that shape how we think about, again, the coming age of Reagan, as it's been called by some historians.
So in your fifth chapter, we get to move into that age of Reagan, and you've already outlined a lot of what the defense industry looks like in this period, but just to sort of take us home in this last chapter, what are you talking about here?
So Reagan takes office in 1981. And what Reagan says is, we are behind the Soviet Union in nuclear and military capabilities, that we need a defense buildup of proportions that, you know, rival essentially the Vietnam War. And defense as a portion of GDP is, you know, I think around this point, 4 or 5% of GDP. Defense spending, the height of defense spending as it relates to GDP is during the Korean War, is 15% of GDP. It never reaches that number again. It's 9% again, or it goes up to 9% during the Vietnam War, and it goes down after that. So it's about, I think, 5% of GDP around this time, 1980s. And Reagan says that's far too little. Soviet Union has done too much, or has outpaced us, and we need to do more. And so Reagan advocates for a defense buildup, which is going to mean the injection of federal dollars into the defense industry in terms of both, again, conventional weapons, but manufacturing, again, all the things that we think about in terms of making war, but also new programs, missile defense programs in particular, that will deter the Soviet Union, but also be a way to signal to the Soviet Union that the United States is serious about renewing its military capabilities. And what I focus on in the chapter is, in particular, the development of Strategic Defense Initiative, or SDI, which is first announced in 1983. And what SDI, you know, for those who don't know, SDI was a complicated, convoluted, I would argue, missile defense system that was designed, the conception of it was going to be satellites in space that would be equipped with lasers that could essentially shoot Soviet ICBMs, signal to other satellites the capability to shoot or to signal to satellites or coordinate amongst each other and signal the capability for the United States to shoot Soviet ICBMs out of the sky if indeed the Soviet Union decided to launch a nuclear attack against the United States, and the belief that So you know, would do that was quite high at this time. And you see that reflected in American culture, movies like The Day After, things like that. The sense of renewed Armageddon that you felt or would have felt in the 1940s and 50s during those years of the Cold War. It's very much present in the 80s. And I do get into a little bit of sort of the cultural effects, the political cultural effects of SDI, but I'm more interested in who is benefiting, again, economically, materially from this, again, belief, consensus that the United States must fight the Cold War through massive military power. And what I find is that, again, as you saw in the 50s and 60s, some Americans are benefiting more than others. And SDI is, you know, there's not much to manufacture for SDI. It's relatively nothing to manufacture for SDI. So what you really need is again, PhDs, an educated workforce who doesn't need a lot of space to do their work. They're ensconced in certain places like DC, Maryland, in skyscrapers, you know, doing experiments. They're in Colorado, employed by Martin Marietta, which is the main contractor for SDI. And they are doing quite well. If you're in an industry that doesn't require you to produce things, and as engaging intellectual development of a weapon and experiments of this kind, then you're doing quite well. But for many Americans who would be employed in other parts of the defense industry or other parts of the economy of the Cold War, they're not doing so well. And this is certainly the case in the traditional manufacturing base, as I said, at the outset of the post-Common Cold War in Northeast and Midwest. And what I look at in the chapter, in the last chapter, the fifth chapter, is how this affects New York and Connecticut, defense industries in New York and Connecticut, and communities that rely upon the defense industries in those states. And what you see, what I saw in doing the research was they are not very pleased with Reagan's defense buildup. They don't see that they're benefiting from it. And in fact, a number of factories close, thousands of Americans lose their jobs in New York and Connecticut, and also to a certain extent in Missouri, places like in the West. And they are voting for Ronald Reagan, interestingly enough, as president, but on a national or a local level, they're voting for Democrats and Republicans who promise them that they're going to save their jobs from being cut. And so what I'm arguing first and foremost is that Reagan's defense buildup, Reagan overall, his domestic and foreign policies benefit a few to the detriment of most. And that we should see Reagan's defense policies as foreign policies as constructed within a context of inequality, what Judith Stein has called, the age of inequality. And what this means for many Americans is that by the 1980s and 1990s, they are not working in the defense industry anymore, at least in the parts of the book, or the areas that I concentrate in the book, New York and Connecticut. And they are angry about that, and they're voting for increasingly Republicans after the 1990s who promised lower taxes, who promised them greater control over their decisions in terms of localities, but also promised them more defense spending. DuPont promised them that they're going to again increase the military budget, which is interesting because, in fact, again, Reagan promised that but didn't deliver materially to them. And so it puts Americans in this, who benefit from the Cold War, in this weird position increasingly of ideologically supporting many Republicans, voting for them, but materially not benefiting as much as they would, but still feeling like they have to vote for, or they should vote for the GOP. And the Democrats in the same position where they're, or similar position where they're, you know, many of them are opposed to Reagan's defense policies, opposed to his foreign policy, you know, don't like that Reagan has committed so much to the military, to the detriment of social programs. But many members of Congress, when of course, when it comes down to saving their constituents' jobs, they're advocating for those defense programs that they feel are being cut. And so they're actually pushing Reagan to do more in terms of creating or spending more on the military. So it's putting Democrats in this position where they have to feel they have to justify their anti-militarist rhetoric with more militarism. It's kind of a weird position. And so this is, I think, shaping the Democratic Party today, where, you know, they're still voting in large numbers with Republicans on Democrats, not exclusively because of, again, parochial politics. When I call parochial politics in the book, you know, economic material issues, and keeping their jobs in Congress, you know, that kind of thing, but also for ideological reasons. But it's still overall bipartisan support, bipartisan consensus support around what the United States should be doing through its defense budget. That is not just using its defense budget to go after perceived enemies abroad, but also to creating jobs and growth for Americans at home.
So something I think that's interesting is you, in some ways, bookend the monograph with anecdotes from the 1990s about drawdowns in defense spending and how the tremendous anxiety it understandably produces in people who are dependent on it for his livelihood. But, and yet, military spending never really seems to go anywhere. How do we break free of this? Well, one of the things I was struck by reading this was just these cycles of opposition to military spending that come around but never really lead to long-lasting change. Do you see a way out of that?
I do. I think you have to remain hopeful. because if you don't, you know, it becomes too deterministic. And I think that's something I wanted to avoid with the book. I think you're right. That's what I saw, was these patterns of opposition that, again, seem to have an opening, seem to have moved the Overton window a little bit, but in the end don't quite make enough, or, you know, don't have enough allies, or don't make a dent enough in the defense budget and in how Americans view the defense budget and what it's done for them. And therefore, militarism persists and ensues in some ways, you know, even in greater terms than originally. But I do think there is opportunity. I think one thing you need in to sort of, you know, as you said, to kind of rethink our commitment to defense spending and to the military. One thing I think we do have right now is the Overton window opening to a certain extent. I think with the critique of endless wars, with the long, I think Americans' longstanding opposition to involvement in countries militarily, that overall, there's been times of support that you see for, you know, Iraq recently in Afghanistan, but overall, I would say in the long history of American support for military interventions, and it's quite limited. And I think people should capture that and seize upon it to keep reiterating that in some ways to open the Overton window further. I think you have organizations like Quincy Institute who are now trying to build institutions in Congress, trying to convince policymakers that a policy of restraint, demilitarization, is in the best interest of not just the country, important as it is, of course, but their constituents. And I say country, not security, but constituents as well. And I think you also have what Bernie Sanders has done is created opportunities for activists on the ground to do greater work. I think the challenge on behalf of demilitarizing American foreign policy, I think the challenge is to create a coalition that would would be lasting in ways that I like, did not see throughout the Cold War. I think that's hard because what I saw frequently during the Cold War, and what I think is might happen now, is that a new foreign policy event comes up, and Vietnam, Korea, one of those major events come up, and it closes opportunities. It restricts avenues for opposition to American to large scale military spending, and it puts people in position where Americans in position again where they're asked to, by others, Pulitzer's elites, like, do you support America to intervene in this place to defend its national security? And of course, many Americans will say yes, and that forms the basis for consensus or for a decision, new consensus or a set of decisions around how American foreign policy should be engaging in a more interventionist sense throughout the world. I think that's the problem, is creating a coalition that will be lasting in a way that neutralizes any effort on the part of certain members of or certain elites, certain people who are supportive of interventionist foreign policy, neutralizes them to the point that it will deter a decision that would lead to a greater commitment of American forces abroad, and therefore an increased defense budget. But I do think we are at a great advantageous time, I think we're at a better position now than we were 10 years ago, let's put it that way, just to consider these things, to think about them. And I do think institutionally, those who are opposed to militarism are in a better place than where they were 10 years ago. And I think those are encouraging signs, and we should hold on to them and build upon them going forward.
That makes a lot of sense. Now that you've finished this book, and this will be my last question before I let you go off and enjoy your weekend, what are you thinking of working on next?
I have a couple of projects in mind. So I think one project would be that I've written up a short proposal on is how small conflicts become permanent conflicts. How America's wars become endless wars. So thinking about the ways in which, relatively short military conflict, lasting military conflict, so War of 1898, for instance, which is over in a matter of months, in 1898, how that leads to an enduring endless conflict, to a certain extent, I would say, or over America's influence in Caribbean, Latin America, Philippines, of course, in Asia, which is Philippines becomes a colony of the United States afterward, 1898 up until World War II, and how that shapes the conflicts that are to come in those parts of the world. So looking at War of 1898, the intervention in the Dominican Republic, looking at how the Korean War and the opposition to communists or those who are communism in Korea, those who are involved in working on behalf of the North Korean state, the United States goes after them as well, militarily, and that shapes the Vietnam War in a counterinsurgency fashion that they go after communists in ways that shape the Vietnam War, which of course is going to influence how we think about conflict today. That's something it's an idea I've been kicking around, I've yet to tease out fully. And the other is just a completely different project on history of progressives, which I've worked more on. I started working on this book on Hubert Humphrey, which turned somewhat into a book on Hubert Humphrey and Lyndon Johnson, looking at Cold War liberalism and shaping ideas, how cultural liberalism shapes ideas for what's possible in terms of domestic spending and regards to full employment and healthcare, things like that. John Humphrey to be the personification of American limitations and opportunities for building a post-war welfare state. But I think over time I don't see a project developing out of that. And I think what might be more interesting is taking the research from that project and thinking about the ways in which progressives form coalitions through advocating for the United States be, you know, holding up to its responsibility as the most wealthy nation in the world. You saw this in the Bernie Sanders campaign and other campaigns that the United States have. This is, you know, reiterated today, you know, 2020. The United States is the richest nation in the world. How is it possible that we're not able to have universal healthcare or maternity leave, things like that? And how activists, progressive activists, and coalitions are built around American prosperity. And what that means for achieving equality, racial equality, economic equality on these issues. So American prosperity actually hurting and helping progressives in the post-war period. So those are the two projects I've kicked around. I don't know if both of those will be viable. you know, I can't know if I've been, that is, I don't know if I can do them both at the same time. But I've been rethinking things, as I'm sure many historians have, in the context of COVID and access to archives. And I think that's obviously probably another story, another podcast. But I've yet to determine what comes next. But it's probably going to be one of those projects. We'll see if a publisher is interested in either one. And that's probably the one I'll do based upon what's most publishable for presses.
Sounds good. I look forward to seeing which direction you decide to go in. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Zed. Thanks for having me.